Welcome back to the long, long anticipated series 5 of Countries That Don't Exist Anymore. Hi, Phil.
Who are you then?
Oh, Phil, the banter gets straight off to an amazing start. But you know, it really has been definitely our longest series break. And
several countries have been invented and then disappeared.
Well, that's it. That is what happens. They've just sort of, yeah, as you said, popped out of existence. But we have been inundated with fans on Twitter.
Is that on social media websites that don't exist anymore?
Yes, this is from X, the new fascist social media news website. We have a message from Sherilyn Hardon, and she says, "You must be the best luckiest man ever, countries, since I'm extremely frisky ATM and I would be satisfied to add you for my private video show." That was from Sherilyn.
We should get her on as a guest.
We've had Randa Losberg. "Hi there, countries. I'm so elated you connected my face. I would be thrilled to talk with you on my private site for free."
Well, thanks, Randa.
Mabel Collicott says, "You must be the top favoured man ever, countries, since I'm too frisky right now and I would be blissful to invite you for my private video show." And Nice Girl just says, "Hello."
Oh, that's so nice. That's Nice.
That's very
nice.
That's
great. Being inundated. And I like also how they address you by the name Countries.
Yes, that is our short name. I think, obviously, if you were some sort of porn chatbot, you would just assume their first name has got to be Countries and their surname is Don't Exist Anymore.
That Don't Exist Anymore. Their
parents had a divorce between Don't Exist and Anymore. So that's what happens. But anyway, thank you for all those messages. That's very exciting. Obviously, it's been a big break, but we're going to do things a little bit differently this series. For one thing, we decided to do one main episode a month. We no longer have Patreon because I feel it's a bit unfair to not do anything for a year and just to be like, guys, fund my website. So,
yes.
So I decided, thank you so much if you were on Patreon, and thank you for all your support, but stand down. But if you do want to donate, there is a PayPal link on the site, so you can still donate as much or as little as you want through that. Series 5 kicks off with a journey to the medieval West African empire of Ouagadou, also known as the Ghana Empire.
Ghana?
Yep.
Newsflash, Ed. Do you know that Ghana still exists, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the matter? Don't you have any more countries that don't exist, you know, anymore?
Actually, modern Ghana has nothing to do with the historic Ghana Empire, aka Ouagadou.
That's just confusing, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. Different people, different time, different locations. You see, this OG Ghana was based in what's now modern West Mali and Southeast Mauritania. But that's not the only example in Africa, if you're talking about being confused, Phil. Because modern Benin has nothing to do with ancient Benin. Mauritania, nowhere near old Mauritania.
So if it has nothing to do with ancient Ghana, then why did modern Ghana call itself Ghana?
Well, modern Ghana, which was formerly known as the Gold Coast, was founded in 1957 with a lot of internal divisions. So the name was borrowed from history to harken back to this mighty African civilization, pretty much just to channel some of the greatness of the historical Ghana Empire. But even the name Ghana Empire is a tautology of sorts, since empire is a bunch of kingdoms being ruled by a top king. And the word Ghana actually just means warrior chief or king. So when you say Ghana Empire, all you're really saying is Kingdom of Kings, king. Anyway, for the purposes of this episode, we'll be calling the Ghana Empire what it was called by the local Saninki people, aka Ouagadou.
Welcome to Series 5 and the brand new theme tune of
Countries Don't Exist Anymore.
What does Ouagadou mean?
Ouagadou means place of the wag. Not Premier League football wives and girlfriends wag, but in fact nobility. So Ouagadou means lord's place. One tradition states that Ouagadou was established after a man called Dinga Cisse, who came from somewhere else far away, fathered lots of children who themselves became local rulers.
Any veracity to this account, Ed?
Well, Dinga is said to have then killed a goblin, but married the goblin's daughters and had two sons with them called Kine and Diabe, who fought each other until Diabe was victorious and established Wagadu.
Ah, so yes then.
Well, like most myths, it's probably a bit true and probably a bit not.
Well, it must be true. I mean, who would brag about being related to a goblin? Except the British royal family, of course.
The problem with the history around the founding of Wagadu is it's kind of been the preserve of a lot of 19th and 20th century European historians just arguing over who the founders of Wagadu actually were. Some think North African Berbers, others Judeo-Syrians.
And still others, goblins.
Unsurprisingly, very few colonial types could really stomach the idea that an illustrious West African empire could have been founded by West Africans.
No.
I know. But most recent archaeological work at the suspected capital city of Kumbi Saleh suggests that Wagadu may have been established and ruled by local people.
Now, actually, Ed, I'm still leaning into this goblin theory.
Yeah, well, do a YouTube channel about it, Phil.
Well, I will.
Yeah, well, do your own research, Phil.
And it's going to be more popular than this podcast.
Well, I mean, that's not difficult. Yeah. Speaking of Kumbi Saleh, this was a gleaming capital of possibly more than 20,000 people, which at its height in the year 1000 AD had twice the population of London.
Whoa, what, London now?
No, London at the time.
That
said, Kumbi Saleh had two large wells providing safe, clean drinking water, something that even modern London can't always manage. I wouldn't know. I live in Surrey now. It's much nicer. Better
sorry,
quality
Ed,
of life.
Sorry, just to pause you there. I'm just going to just have a little sip of delicious water.
Kumbi Saleh wasn't just one city. It was actually made of two separate towns 6 miles away from each other.
Ah, so the Windsor and Slough of their day.
At its height, one of the two towns was inhabited by Muslim dignitaries, having 12 mosques and containing all the administrative functions of government. The other town was pretty much the court of the king, with his palace, sacred groves and pleasure gardens.
Do you know, I really don't get the term pleasure gardens. I mean, you know, they're all right in general, but what's so great about lying on grass?
Yeah, I think this was before the comfortable sofas and large screen TVs of the late 20th century living room.
That's very depressing.
I mean, it's better than gardens. In many parts of West Africa, buildings were, and are, made of mud brick. But Wagadu had stone deposits, and therefore urban houses were apparently stone structures, which could be several stories high and separated by narrow streets, with a grander avenue running through the centre of town, lined with all the traders and food stalls that kept Kumbi Saleh buzzing.
I was expecting this African kingdom to be all flying cars and energy weapons.
No, you're thinking of Wakanda. I mean, as advanced as Kumbi Saleh was, this is the medieval era. So just think agriculture, economic inequality, and so forth.
With ya. Who were the Soninke?
Well, were and are, since there are still 2 million Soninke in West Africa.
Who are the Soninke?
No, well, I'm going to tell you who were the Soninke.
Oh. Have you who got are the Soninke?
No.
Who were the Soninke?
Great. As well as being a dab hand with leather, iron and gold, the Soninke were quite a militaristic bunch, with highfalutin ideas about fighting and chivalry, and fairly elitist ideas around caste and standing. For example, combat was only permitted between men of similar rank and was limited to a sword and spear per person. If someone lower in rank came for a fight, the higher status warrior would show their contempt by only producing a whip or saddle girth.
Right, so if you didn't like someone, you whipped out your girth. Hey, it really was the Slough of its day.
One reason that the Soninke were able to dominate was that they may have been the first people in the region to master metal-tipped weapons, especially arrows. Blacksmiths were highly prized in Wagadu society. The Soninke name for forge was also the same word used for a magical egg that hatched at the beginning of creation, with all life pouring out of it. Blacksmiths in Wagadu belonged to guilds, and their knowledge was highly secretive and prized. To normal people, blacksmiths seemed to hold magical powers, as they were able to take metals from the earth and transform them into incredible objects.
And for my next trick, it's a spork.
What was it like being poor in Ouagadou?
Although society was obviously stratified, what with having a gold-wearing king in charge of everything and all that, it was apparently a fairly charitable one, with the wealthy required to give away 1/20th of their income to the poor.
Whoa, 5% tax. They must have had excellent accountants.
This system was called Jaka, which meant that the poor, old and disabled were taken care of a bit.
Yeah, in other words, they were given Jaka all. How long did Ouagadou last?
From about 300 to at least about the 1100s, and probably a little later.
Shit, that's long!
That is long. That's at least 800 years of Ouagadou-y goodness. It's always difficult to say when such an ancient empire comes to an end, but by 1240, Ouagadou had been fully absorbed into the Mali Empire. And, like all significant places, Ouagadou didn't just disappear into the Sahara sands. It kick-started a series of wealthy empires, like the Mali, then the Songhai, that lasted right up to good old European colonisation. And when I say good old, I mean bad old. But the empires of West Africa enjoyed thousands of years of prosperity because of one shiny commodity that Homo sapiens can't seem to get enough of.
iPhone 12?
Gold.
Woohoo! I'm rich! Rich, I tells you!
Ouagadou, at its richest, was stinking rich. The king was known as Kaya Margun, a.k.a. King of Gold.
You're covered in gold.
14 karat gold.
Think the British royal family claiming ownership of swans is a bit overbearing? Apparently, the king of Ouagadou claimed all nuggets of gold found as belonging to him, only allowing his subjects gold dust. According to the 11th century Arabic scholar Al-Bakri, it is related that the king owns a nugget as large as a big stone.
Well, I'm afraid that's a bit vague to be impressive. Like, how big is a big stone?
Well, like a smallish rock.
Oh, you mean like a tiny boulder?
Yeah.
Impressive. Most impressive.
In 951, historian Ibn Hakul wrote that the king of Ghana was the richest king on the face of the earth. Al-Bakri described a courtly scene.
He sits in audience, or to hear grievances against officials, in a domed pavilion, around which stand 10 horses covered with gold-embroidered materials. Behind the king stand pages holding shields and swords decorated with gold. And on his right are the sons of the kings of his country wearing splendid garments and their hairs plaited with gold. The governor of the city sits on the ground before the king, and around him are ministers seated likewise. At the door of the pavilion are dogs of excellent pedigree that hardly ever leave the place where the king is, guarding him. Around their necks they wear collars of gold and silver studded with a number of balls of the same metals.
Well, I guess they were golden retrievers.
Oh, I'll tell you what, Ed, we might have had a break, but you certainly haven't lost, you know, whatever it is you had. But hang on, with all this gold and gold-wearing dogs, shouldn't they have been worried about inflation?
Actually, according to Al-Bakri, that's exactly why the crown effectively yoinked all the gold nuggets. Even then, it was supposedly understood that too much gold being allowed to flow would make it worthless.
Is that really why the king kept all the gold?
Absolutely, Phil. It's vital that there is strictly enforced economic inequality in society. Because reasons.
Well, trickle-down gold dust.
Hmm.
But where did all that money come from?
Ouagadou was located on the Sahel, then a savanna region in Africa that separated the desert to the north and jungle to the south, with plenty of grazing land for animals, fertile farmland and major rivers aplenty for irrigation and trade. The place was practically screaming out for some pretty advanced civilizing. Agriculture had been happening in this part of Africa since at least 3500 BC, possibly as early as 6000 BC. This would put West African civilization on par with the very earliest anywhere in the world. Wagadu used its military to make sure it was the sweet spot for the trading gold, salt, animal hides, copper, beads, and lots of people sat around itching to be sold into slavery. And all this was lined up with Saharan trade routes, which opened up in the 3rd century AD thanks to the introduction of the camel to the region. And these trade routes linked the southern tip of Africa via the Silk Road right the way over to the far reaches of China. So Wagadu's key trade was based on mining gold mines to the south and then taking that gold north to pay for salt that was mined in the Sahara Desert to the north. And if you're thinking, why salt, you know, you get it in little packets, the answer is that it was a lot more scarce and hard to come by at the time. Plus, the primary use of salt at the time wasn't to make chips magically delicious, it was about food preservation. Salt was the LG InstaView fridge freezer of its day.
I discovered something recently, by the way. You can get salt and vinegar as a powder.
What?
Yep, it's ingenious. Put it on popcorn and thank me.
Well, you should start your own sub-Saharan trading empire, Phil.
I may well do.
Great. But whether the trade was in salt, gold, brocade, ivory, copper, or even ostrich feathers, since Wagadu sat in the middle of all this trade, all they had to do was tax merchants when they entered their lands and when they left them.
Sweet, sweet taxation. What kind of government did Wagadu have?
Well, we know that the emperor of Wagadu was the king of kings, you know, so there's no reason to think this wasn't, you know, an absolute power setup, except for the fact there was a whole town devoted to civil servants and dignitaries.
Yeah, checks out. Do you know what I'd do if I had absolute power?
Make someone else do all the actual work?
Exactly.
Finally, absolute power. All my years of scheming and murdering have paid off. All bow to me. You know what this means.
The once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to shape the state in the way that makes it work for its people, Your Majesty?
What? No! Unlimited funding for my twin passions of drinking and prostitutes. You do all the admin stuff. Come on, prostitutes!
Very good, Your Majesty.
We have accounts that the emperor kept the sons of lesser kings close by to be brought up in his royal household, thus bringing them up to feel a bond to the system, as well as having their neck on the line should their dear old daddies back home do anything crazy like go into rebellion. Whether Aztec, Roman or British, it's a classic empire tactic. One thing that's unusual about Wagadu was that the throne was inherited matrilineally. So, rather than the throne just being passed to sons, it was instead passed to the sons of the sister.
Wow. Hey, is that because African societies were incredibly progressive and enlightened?
Yeah, either that, or it meant the heir to the throne would be of the direct bloodline, meaning the king could sleep with whomever he wants and not worry about producing lots of bastards claiming the throne, because it's whoever slept with the queen... Well, it's the queen's baby, so royal blood.
Ha ha ha! Come on, prostitutes!
Who were the kings of Wagadu?
While the historical records are too patchy to be able to have anything like a line of succession, we do hear accounts of two named kings and a suggestion that there were lots and lots more. Again, this comes from Muslim scholars like Al-Bakri, who never actually visited the place, but a lot of his writing is based on earlier writings that were subsequently lost, so take it all with a pinch of salt.
Fridge of its day.
For example, one king known as Bassi, who died in 1063, became ruler at the age of 85. According to Al-Bakri, he led a praiseworthy life because of his love of justice and friendship for the Muslims. Historically objective? No. Record of Wagadu king making accommodation to the growing number of Muslims in the kingdom? Probably. Anyway, at the end of his life, Bassi became blind, but pretended he could see.
Classic when, trick.
Yeah, when something was put before him, he said, "This is good," or "This is bad." His ministers would apparently help the king by giving out cryptic hints.
Your Majesty, I present you a carving of your likeness.
What an insult! Take him away and execute him!
Oh, two coughs? I mean, this is good.
So the king that followed him, and the only other one we have a name for, is Garna Tenkamanin. So he was apparently born in 1037 and was crowned at the age of about 25, but accounts of him are hard to pin down. But a lot of trade and anti-inflationary measures were attributed to his reign. According to accounts, he was also the people's king, in that he'd ride on horseback around the kingdom, listening to ordinary people's concerns.
And what do you do?
I work at the salt mines, but conditions are terrible. There have been cave-ins that have killed many, and they don't pay us enough. My children are starving!
How absolutely splendid.
What religion did Wagadoo have?
When we've talked about lots of nations around this time period, whether it's Mercia or Aksum, generally we find a transition of religion from multiple gods to monotheism. And Wagadoo's no exception. Early religion was all spirits and magic animals, and later Wagadoo gradually shifts to Islam. One tradition says that the wealth of Wagadoo was granted by a seven-headed python called Bida. Bida provided gold every time it rained.
Ah! Ooh!
Ooh! Ah! Ow!
Ooh!
Ooh!
Fucking
gold!
Ah!
Rain! Bloody gold rain!
This rain is a mixed blessing!
Hey guys, am I late? I was told there were golden showers.
Now, Bida was said to have made a deal with the kings of Wagadoo, but all in exchange for an annual human sacrifice of a young virgin girl. But one year, rather than allowing the sacrifice to go ahead, a horny local hero called Amadou actually killed the snake to have his way with the girl, causing Wagadoo to be plunged into terminal depression. I'm sure I saved a girl you were prepared to sacrifice as a small price to pay for your ongoing prosperity, thus condemning you all to internal poverty. Receive mixed reviews.
Still, good news about the chocolate oranges.
But there are some interesting things to take from this myth. You know, like all myths. After all, serpent worship was once a big thing in this part of Africa, and still is in some places. Snakes were practically divine.
Because you have done this, you are cursed more than all cattle, and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel.
Well, I'm pretty big in Africa, so...
Anyway, as well as snakes, we're told that before Islam, the people of Wagadoo also worshipped carvings or idols that could be kept in woods and guarded by holy men or sorcerers. We call the worshippers of this religion animists.
Right now, I am an animista. That's not like anime, but I worship animals.
And apparently when kings were buried, they were brought on comfy beds, put into domes, which were then covered with earth. And they were buried with their servants, who apparently volunteered for the honour.
Yes, I do hope to spend eternity with my line manager too.
What did people of Wagadoo wear?
Those that followed the king's religion were apparently forbidden from wearing clothes sewn together by thread. That was reserved for royalty. Velcro was probably fine. All other people wore robes of cotton, silk, or brocade according to their means. The men were clean-shaven, while the women shaved their heads. The king was very finely decorated, and he wore necklaces and bracelets on his forearms. On his head, he wore a high cap decorated with gold and wrapped in a turban of fine cotton. However, animism aside, by 1068, Islam was more a dominating force in Wagadoo. Most, if not all, of the top officials and aristocrats were Muslim. Not only was Islam spread on the trade routes, but next-door kingdoms like Takrur had also made the switch. Maybe it was the undeniable truth of the prophet, PBAH, or of a sweetener to trading relations, or a bit of both. Anyway, it seemed that
everybody wants to be Muslim!
Except the king. The king and his heirs kept to the old religion. So, when people of the old religion approached the king, they'd kneel and sprinkle dust on their heads. But when Muslims approach the king, they just have to clap their hands. Ay!
Monday, Tuesday, wagadoo.
Tuesday, Wednesday, wagadoo. Wednesday, Thursday, wagadoo. Thursday, Friday, wagadoo. Friday, Saturday,
good,
wagadoo.
With all these songs, I just don't know why our podcast Sunday, isn't more popular. Wagadoo.
It's a mystery, Sunday, Phil. Monday, it's a wagadoo. Mystery. Monday, but Tuesday, here's wagadoo. Where we have to question some Tuesday, of the Islamic Wednesday, scholars. Wagadoo. You see, they tell us...
Ed, sorry, I just need to turn this off. It felt like a good idea at the time. Hold on.
Friday, Saturday, wagadoo.
Oh, that's better. Right, but here we have to question yada yada yada.
That the kings of Wagadu actually converted to Islam, but it doesn't seem to be any proof of this. One story goes that there was a great drought, so the king called for an imam to ask him what to do about it. The imam said that the king should convert to Islam, and as soon as he did, there was rain from the sky. Now, for one thing, there's no evidence that the kings of Wagadu ever converted to Islam.
Yeah, and when I think of the holiest Islamic places in general, I rarely think, you know what their problem is? Excess precipitation.
Yes, Phil, I'd love to live in an Islamic country, but just a bit too drizzly. But either way, the growing influence of Islam over Wagadu is undeniable. We hear from 12th century accounts that the scholars of Wagadu were being sent to Al-Andalus, aka Islamic Spain. Plus, lots of the elite had made the pilgrimage to Mecca, throwing around so much gold that they generally left inflation wherever they went. So, Wagadu were clearly movers and shakers in the Islamic world, and the rulers of the follow-up empires were most definitely Muslim.
Why did Wagadu decline and then fall?
So there's a commonly held idea that Wagadu was conquered by the Almoravid dynasty.
Who were the Almoravid dynasty?
Well, short answer, in the 1050s, the Almoravid dynasty were formed in northwest Africa. The Almoravids followed a very strict form of Islam and decided that it would be a great idea for everybody else to as well. In a lightning campaign, they worked their way down the west coast of Africa until they were on the borders of Wagadu in 1055. They also formed an alliance with the king of Takrur, who wasn't a big fan of fun either. In 1076, the Almoravids took the capital after a struggle lasting a decade.
Wow, that was abrupt.
That's because it might have never happened.
What?
See, Google Wagadu and most people take it as read that this is what happened. But really, there's little evidence that it actually ever did. In fact, there's just as much evidence to suggest that Wagadu had dominion over the Almoravids. See, scholars all disagree, as do historians. If there was an invasion of the capital, Kumbe Saleh, where's the damage in the archaeological records? But then what if Kumbe Saleh may have not been the capital, or maybe the capital moved around a lot or changed during the invasion? It's really hard to reach a conclusion with so little evidence.
Evidence? Come on, Poindexter. The listeners of CTDEA don't want all this shilly-shallying. They want juice, sauce, goss. Who's bonking who? Are there any snake orgies? Which ancient king had been slagging off which other ancient king? Who conquered who? So did the Almoravids invade and set things on fire and murder and rape, or didn't they? Or did they? Or didn't they?
I don't know.
No, you can't spell I don't know without no. What's the opposite of no?
Yes.
Exactly. So cool, curvy sword conquest it is. Thank you very much.
Well, maybe. But let's also consider...
climate change.
Yes, good old climate change. So at the beginning of our story, Wagadu is this green oasis of river valleys and pastures between desert to the north and jungle to the south. But as we approach the first millennium, all that's changing. The climate grows hotter and drier. The Sahara's creeping south. Productive land becomes arid. Rivers and wells dry up. The people of Wagadu move south right out of Wagadu, and with a declining population, the empire lost its hold on the territories it had controlled for hundreds of years. And the real memory of climate change also enters folklore. You remember the great snake Beda, the python? Well, in the first version of the story, the snake just guaranteed wealth in a non-specific way. But in another story, Beda actually provided the water which actually fueled this civilization. See, Beda lived in one of the great wells of Wagadu, and also caused the rain to fall, and it was only at the time that Beda would slither away to eat the virgin sacrifice that the locals could actually access the well where it lived.
Well, great news then. Big Snake is dead, and therefore people get unlimited access to water.
You'd think, but upon Beda's death, the well dried up, and the rain stopped falling. An important lesson to us all.
Yep, yep, yep. Don't kill giant snakes unless you find out how that snake is dynamically part of the water cycle first.
Exactly. And although the story of Beda the Python seems a bit random, there's some sense to the legend. See, we've already talked about snake worship, but why did it happen? And why a python in particular? One reason might be that in times of drought, pythons burrow underground to water sources. So pythons were closely connected in the imagination to water sources. Dead pythons meant no water. No water meant a bad time for everybody. And there's something even more than that. Every time it rained in West Africa, the rainwater would wash away soil, and actually gold nuggets would be found in the ground. So in what were called the gold fields. So literally you can see why this idea of Beda causing the rain and gold falling from the sky, where that comes from. It's because every time it rains, there's gold all of a sudden. So if you take away the snake, you take away the water, you take away the source of the gold. Anyway, it's really an interesting myth, and it kind of explains the fall of Wagadu, or how people like to explain it. With all those peasants skedaddling and the tax base eroding, the wealth of Wagadu certainly took a massive hit. But I mean, the thing is, you don't need a stable climate to mine gold. And that may have kept Wagadu afloat, except that other gold mines were coming online in the 11th and 12th century at Bure, which is modern Guinea. And at the same time, new trade routes were springing up further east. So there was loads of competition happening as Wagadu was declining. And whether you buy the Almoravid invasion or not, conquest was always on the cards, because internal divisions and weakness will always make you a tempting target for other powers. In the 1190s, or thereabouts, the kingdom of Soso to the fertile south rose to prominence and gobbled up parts of Wagadu's lands that contained the iron and the gold mines. Then, so-so about the rise of Soso, a confederation of states defeated them and formed the Mali Empire, with Wagadu as a mere vassal state.
All right, well, that was the so that's the history of Ghana. Sorry, I mean Wagadu.
Yeah, it's interesting because we haven't done much African history before. We kind of did Carthage, but that's kind of in the Mediterranean world.
But we did Aksum.
Yeah, that's true. We did do Aksum. But like, I feel like Aksum's a bit different because it has a line of continuity almost up to the present day. Yeah. You know, like it had the same kind of monarchy, or at least the same sort of tradition, kind of running through it right up to the Abyssinian Empire and all that stuff. So even up to the 20th century, and you know, and then Haile Selassie. And I think Wagadu is different because obviously it's something where, although we do have, you know, like the Mali Empire, I think is quite famous. There are some very famous and very powerful sub-Saharan African nations and empires, but I think we've lost so much to history. You know, the slave trade, yes, obviously, but the lack of writing and the fact that we're completely having to depend on like these Muslim scholars just to go with what we have to go on. You know, I remember when we were doing this thing about there was even like lack of archaeological research for, you know, something quite well known, you know, like, you know, in Ethiopia and Aksum. But with Wagadu, I mean, it's insane. There's so little. So I really want to get into these kind of, you know, countries that don't exist anymore in Africa, because it's just such a giant place with such a rich history. But it's difficult because there's not...
It's a rich history that can't be relied on.
That's right. It's a rich
history. Our favourite kind at countries that don't exist anymore.
That was the history. The history of...
I thought that was a great history of Ouagadougou, not Ghana.
Yeah, I mean, don't worry. It's very easy to mix up Ouagadougou and Ghana when you're talking about the place. That's why I've written a catchy song to help you remember.
Do you mean the following one that I will have arranged, sang and recorded, Ed?
Whatever.
Talking Ouagadougou. It's not the Ghana that you knew. Once an ancient civilization, the other is a modern nation. It doesn't matter what you have to say. The two are miles and miles and miles away. Ouagadougou, not Ghana, is all I want to say to you. Ouagadougou, not Ghana, medieval, not brand new. Ouagadougou, not Ghana, is all I want to say to you. Ouagadougou, not Ghana, find a map, you'll see it's true.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that first episode of series, God knows, five-ish, of Countries That Don't Exist Anymore. If you want to send us any spam messages on X, please do get in touch. We're at CTDEAPod. Or we're on Facebook, soon to be called X, at CTDEAPod. And email at ctdeapod@gmail.com. Hopefully we'll have another episode, will we, Ed?
Yes, we certainly will have another
episode. What's it about?
Well, as explained earlier, readers, our episodes now will definitely happen on a monthly basis, and then every so often when we have a great guest or whatever, we'll do a little in-between you one for you. But the next main episode is on the Endeavour of Fiume, which was a short-lived experiment of free love, anarchy, and pasta in 1919. Nice. Actually, this episode was requested by Brian Pritzel, who made a donation to the show at ctdeapod.com. So if you'd like a country you'd like to be featured on the show, get in touch and we'll add it to the old historical playlist. I mean, making a donation isn't essential, but cash helps us pay those web hosting fees, keeps me in history books, so all contributions greatly received.
Ed, is this going to result in some kind of cash for episode scandal?
Yes.
Good, I look forward to it.
Countries don't exist anymore. They used to exist, but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for. It's for countries that don't exist anymore.
And if you're disgusted by this new theme tune, I'm not saying you should start a national campaign to get the old one back, but it would probably do it. And I'm not just saying that so we get our publicity, just if you feel strongly about it. Okay, thank you now, bye.